This is Scenic Roots talking writing. Our guest, David Taher, teaches voice in the music department at Covenant College on Lookout Mountain. He also curates the John Hamm concert series. Every year for the past 6 years, he has programmed 6 performances by a broad range of musicians, actors, and dancers. This Friday on Scenic Roots, we'll be bringing you the most recent concert from the series, featuring the Boston-based pianist, George Lee. Pianist George Lee from a concert at Covenant College in February. The concert, part of the John Hamm performance series, is curated by our guest, David Taher. A professor in the music department, David grew up in New Zealand. He takes great pride in the breadth of the series, and next season he hopes to bring 2 Maori musicians from New Zealand to play music he feels fairly certain has never before been heard in Chattanooga.
They're an adventurous bunch too. So we've done great world music, lots of Americana and jazz and folk. It was originally kicked off by big help from Fletcher Bright. So we had the Dismembered Tennesseans up in our first season, and we have always tried to program a bunch of different stuff, like performing arts in the truest sense. So never too much classical, never too much popular. Dance and theater, really just the variety of things. Because as a liberal arts institution, that's something that's at the core of who we are. And so we wanted to make sure that that was part of the season every year from the get-go. So it's been fun. Very exciting. Always
something
new. I can
only imagine. What a great gig.
Yeah. It's a joy. I mean, it just thinking about all of the things that we get to do and that we get to invite. And I've never had to say no to a fun artist or idea. Just because it doesn't fit who we are as a series. So I've really enjoyed that.
How do you tend to program a season? Do you program stylistically, you know, so many concerts for this and so many concerts for that? Or
usually we'll try to kind of gauge student body makeup as well. So looking at majors, instrumentalists, vocalists, et cetera, and making sure that we have an opportunity for them to see at least one a year for the majors. And then also gauging public interest. So at the end of each season, we send out a survey to our audience members to see what they like or what they want. But really, it's just kind of taking a look at what people like and what they want to hear and what they want to see. And I think, too, there's, as we've started to schedule more theater and dance, it's been an opportunity for us to start to look at current events and social issues and ways that we can use art to shine a light on that and to start conversations around that. So having arts and or music and or theater and where we can engage with the artists on social issues or how they view themselves in society and use them in masterclasses or workshops or talkback sessions so that it never feels like it's just art for the people that can get up the mountain, but it's really art as a catalyst to start a conversation about something else.
This is Scenic Roots talking writing. Our guest, David Taher, is the curator of the John Hamm performance series up at Covenant College. Like the rest of us, David was blindsided when the pandemic hit, just as he was finalizing this year's performance series. He not only had to rethink the lineup of performers, but also how best to present them. The three performances in the fall were all pre-recorded and streamed on the Covenant College website. The three performances this year, beginning with the concert by George Lee, which will be featuring on Scenic Roots on Friday afternoon, was staged in front of a limited, socially distanced audience in the beautiful vaulted concert hall on the Covenant campus.
I'm really fortunate in that Covenant invested heavily in streaming and audio capture technology so that we could have a really high quality version of what was going on live. So this year, all of our concerts are open to faculty and staff and students just because of COVID protocols. And then we're streaming everything online. And so our audience has actually quadrupled because of how open and available it is. And maybe it's just the artists that we've had this year, but all of the artists have been really keen to be able to provide the streams for audiences after the fact for a little bit of time at least, usually about 30 days. But I think it's been great because the most recent, George Lee, who was just here, he said to me afterwards, he was like, you know, you forget how much a part of the performance the audience is. Mm-hmm. And that it just, you forget that there's so much of that dynamic and that conversation between them that when you're doing it in a studio or a closed place, you just kind of get focused on get the music out. And when you're in front of an audience again, it's just like, there's that unspoken dynamic between them, between the performer and the audience, that you just can't manufacture.
So many musicians lament the loss of audience. But I guess it's true as much for them as it is for the rest of us, that everything that we previously took for granted, we now have to reconsider.
Yeah.
I think it's maybe going to change the way people perform.
I definitely think so. I think that it really has. I think that COVID, in a lot of ways, culturally, economically, a lot of things that people were maybe a little more resistant to, whether it's becoming more accessible to their audience or more human, I think that's really making a push towards artists to become much more accessible and much more down to earth in how they interact with their people. I think especially in classical music, there's been kind of this breaking down because all of these artists have been stuck in their houses too. So if they were presenting anything, it was probably from their house. And so we got this window into who they are as people. And that's not necessarily necessary, but I think it kind of is kind of the final breaking down of the diva in culture. I think that especially in classical music, the diva trend has been downward, kind of as opposed to the ascent of the diva. It's kind of been not the fall, but kind of moving away from that. And there are some classical musicians that had embraced that a long time ago. And I think this has really kind of pushed that to be a thing that we've had to deal with as artists and audiences. And I think it's good, though. I think it's really great because we all of a sudden it's kind of a further breaking down the notion that classical music especially is only for a select few number of people. And all of a sudden now it's just getting pushed out there and people get to interact with it and the people that make it in really interesting ways. And I think that's good for everybody.
Me too.
That's just me.
It is interesting, isn't it? And it does seem to be a generational thing that remove that classical musicians, they were kind of separated, not only physically, but it was almost, you know, I guess that is the best way to describe it. It's that diva thing. Is I'm with you, but I'm not of you.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I'm sort of up here to be, you know, admired and to curtsy to, like like royalty.
I enjoy my pedestal.
Pedestal. Yeah. What with the students that you work with now? I mean, they must be aware of that, right? And they're thinking about how they're going to interact with an audience, I guess.
Oh yeah, I think that's very true. And I mean, it's not to say that there's not a reason for people being venerated as spectacular interpreters of music. I think that happens everywhere. And divas are in every style and genre of music. I think it's just, I with my students and kind of our approach to that is we talk about being servants of the music and the audience, that you're there to spark a conversation. You're there to have, and maybe it's not direct communication. You're not speaking your words all the time, but you are having an opportunity to walk through something with your audience. And if you're not looking at it that way, if you're not looking at your purpose from that standpoint, then what are you doing there? Why, you know, why are you wanting to be around people all the time? And yes, you can love music, and yes, you should. There are lots of things that go into being a performer and all of those things. But at the end of the day, it's about affecting someone's life, hopefully for the better, helping them through a moment or a season or a 35-minute stint that you're in front of them, but being able to affect them emotionally, sympathetically. And there is some amount of communication and cooperation between artist and audience that we strive really hard to ingrain in our students, that they are their servants. They're there to serve the audience and the music as well. And it's not, it's about having things in a kind of a right relationship and a right mindset.
Yeah, you know, one of the revelations for me, and probably tells you a lot about me, is the whole notion of a canon, and that classical music, unlike the music I grew up with, vernacular music, is it's the role of the musician is as an interpreter. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, unlike this is the Beatles' new record, this is the new recording of a given piece.
Right.
And so it becomes, you know, almost like a rabbit hole. How do you decide one over another, you know, and because and how different they can be, mm-hmm. you know. The best example I can think of off the top of my head is there was a recording by Bernstein of the of Beethoven's Ninth. Mm-hmm. And I've heard so many different recordings of it since then, but none of them have that. And it wasn't the first recording I'd heard of it either. Mm-hmm. There's a kind of lightness to it that most people seem to not be able to accomplish. And between you and me, the obverse of that, there was a guy who played a concert in Dalton of Chopin pieces. Mm-hmm. I'm like, oh God. I love this music, yeah. And you're playing it like it's so wooden. I'm not feeling anything from what you're playing.
Well, and I think that's the spectacular thing about music is that everybody's personalities come out through it. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's you really do get to see that moment where the artist is truly making something out of something old. And finding a new way to speak through it. And I think people like Bernstein were just spectacular at that, the insight that they bring or brought and the way they are just able to express themselves through somebody else's stuff and things that have been around for hundreds of years, just to be able to find new ways of communicating that to an audience is really, it's just spectacular. And I think that's one of the most exciting things about it is finding the newness in the old. That's really kind of cool.
And, you know, it just occurs to me that, you know, Bernstein was very much a personality.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Definitely.
And because of his personality, he was a conduit for so many people into this music.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And his educational initiatives and all of those things that he did with the young people's concerts is just so multifaceted and really, I think, shaped a generation's experience with music that was thought to be inaccessible.
So what we've been talking about with the online concerts and musicians opening up as people, that's not new.
Oh, no. I don't think so at all. I think, though, COVID has just kind of pushed that a lot faster and a lot further than anybody expected it to be. I mean, and you think about Ellen DeGeneres hosting her show from her house, like it's and Jimmy Fallon and all of these people that all of a sudden you get sort of this intimate knowledge about them that you would have never have expected otherwise, or they probably never would have been okay with otherwise. Some people, maybe some, I won't speak for everyone, But it's just, it's really interesting to see how people have kind of approached that and how they've different artists of different genres have taken that idea and run with it.
I guess it could equally be said that for all of us, this is a sort of public performance of ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
But then as performers, Garth Brooks. He's on Oprah's show,
mm-hmm.
and he's talking about Garth Brooks in the third person. And at the time, I thought, that's bizarre. But now looking back, that's exactly why he did that. He's not Garth Brooks.
Yeah.
You know, in his mind, that's this creation,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Yeah, yep.
So as performers, I guess this is true for classical musicians, anyone else, there's a balance there between who you are and who you present yourself
right.
to the audience as being.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think that there is, and there's, I think that's healthy. I think, you know, you can't always be the person that people want you to be or need you to be. And so I think that especially for people who are in the public eye or have a very public aspect of their lives, I think that's necessary. I think that's probably more a coping mechanism than anything else.
I think it is too.
Yeah.
I have this conversation with students all the time who come here and that they want to be on the air. And I say, well, first of all, bear in mind, this is a completely unnatural situation. And you are trying to make something very unnatural seem very natural.
Yeah.
It takes practice.
Yeah.
Yeah. And don't feel like you fail because you can't do it, you know, because it feels weird.
Mm-hmm.
I can completely understand why anybody would adopt a performance persona.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering though, you know, since this series, this whole season for you has been online, did you choose these performers knowing that, or did you already have the performers selected?
We actually already had the performers selected. It was really funny. We, in, I want to say February, early February 2020, we already had kind of the final slate and were in the beginnings of contract negotiations. And then our school closed on like March 15th or something in person. And so that kind of just threw everything into this sort of unknown. And so we just took it a semester at a time and had to do a couple of changes. We had some international artists that were originally on the books and they weren't able to travel. So we had to postpone those. And then just kind of moving toward what we could do online. Luckily, our spring, this 2021 season or half of the season was all easily done. And the fall season was where it, or the fall half was really where it kind of sucker punched us. just in terms of, we had, I don't know if this was bad planning on my part or whatever, but it just worked out schedule wise that both of our international acts were from the fall. So we had originally planned for three and then we were just left with one. But all of the artists have been really spectacular about adjusting and moving, especially the three artists we'll have this spring. No, I'll backtrack. All of the artists that ended up on this season had substantial online and virtual concert plans. So it wasn't out of the box for them. And for most of them, I think, especially of George, it was his first performance in front of a live audience since the pandemic happened. So that was really, I think that was really exciting for me, but also for them to just be a part of that kind of, hey, you're actually having a live performance and there are real people in the room and they can hear and they can clap and they can react. And so that, I think, was a really exciting aspect of all of our concerts this spring, because I know for two and maybe all three, it's the first time they'll be doing a performance in front of living, breathing audience members.
Oh, cool. Well, let's talk about them. So George Lee has already performed?
Yeah, George Lee was on February 16th. He's an amazing pianist out of Boston. He played Beethoven and Liszt. So really heavy, very romantic, angst-filled, but also, and plenty of release, piano sonatas. And so that was really spectacular, just really wonderful. And then on March 25th, we have Time for Three. And they're a two violins and string bass, upright bass. And they do they have a really eclectic career that ranges from classical music to pop covers. And so they've done a bunch of collaborations with Nashville Symphony, Philadelphia Orchestra, a variety of top-tier classical musicians. But then they've also done a bunch of popular music covers as well as their own compositions that kind of gear a little more towards kind of crossover artists. And so they use all of their expertise as classical musicians to create new songs for their instruments, but then also they sing. So they do Beatles covers and they do Mahler and Coldplay mashups. And it's really, you know, it's just really eclectic. And I was watching them at an arts exchange where a bunch of acts and programmers get together and it's like a conference basically. And I was just sitting there watching them and thinking, man, our students would just love these guys because they're I think who a lot of musicians aspire to be nowadays. They don't have one particular art form that they're limited to or genre that they're limited to, and they get a variety of opportunities. And so I was really intrigued by them. And then on the 20th of April is an actor and playwright out of North Carolina by the name of Mike Wiley. And he is presenting a one-man show. It's called Dar-He, and it's the story of Emmett Till. Emmett Till being the young African-American boy who was lynched in Mississippi. And so he does a one-man show looking at the trial and the coverage of that case, and then does talkback session with the audience afterwards. And he's going to lead some teacher workshops about teaching hard subjects and hard topics, and then also work with theater students about playwriting and acting. And so we have this just really eclectic group as usual, and I'm really excited that they're going to get such a broad audience.
If you stop thinking in terms of genre, right. If you stop thinking in terms of marketing music, you know, and people, I think, again, it's largely on the part of the people doing the marketing, this assumption that if you don't tell people what genre it falls into, they'll be confused or they're not going to be interested or whatever. That's obviously not true.
Right, right.
Especially not with this generation.
Yeah. Well, and I talk with my students about that a lot, the problem of labels. As many problems as they fix by telling you what something is, they're also unnecessarily exclusive. And so it's like, well, in art, labels suck. It's all personal preference. It's all what you want to listen to in any given moment. And so, you know, sometimes you're feeling a little bluesy on your cello, and that's okay because it's there. It's everywhere. And so, that's one great thing. One cool thing about globalization is just the variety of sounds that our ears can hear now and experience and bring into other art forms is really cool. I just love that.
And you said earlier that you solicit audience feedback. I'm just curious, the audience that is attracted to your classical music concerts, what the reaction is to that kind of cross-programming.
We have some very vocal lovers and haters. But our core audience has never gotten mad. They've always loved it, and they've always kind of tucked in for the ride and gone somewhere they didn't expect. And I'm okay if people walk away from a concert and don't like it. I also think partially because we are 100% donor, grant, and school funded, so none of our concerts ever cost the audience anything. That's another opportunity for me to say, okay, so maybe you lost an hour and a half of your life, but you experienced something you wouldn't have normally, and it didn't cost you anything except your time. That's okay. And I think partially because there's not that kind of fiscal investment, people are a little more flexible with what they're doing and what they'll listen to and experience. But our audience has been really generous, I think, across all six seasons. They have always been very generous with the artists that have been brought. And I'm really thankful for that.
Going back to not having parameters, it's right, you know, because it frees you from having to listen to something and assessing it in terms of how it fits the genre.
Right.
And you just listen to it for itself.
Yeah. And I think, too, it's one of those things where when we were designing it and talking about what we wanted the series to be, it was unnecessary distinctions. I didn't want to feel like we had to have a pianist every year and a violinist every year. And because it gets boring. It really does. And there are so many opportunities in Chattanooga to hear all of that different music that I really wanted to be able to add on to what the experience was musically in Chattanooga. And at that point in time, there weren't a lot of, when we started it, there weren't a lot of solo opportunities. And so we had String Theory, which was primarily chamber music, and we had the CSO and their chamber music arm, but there wasn't a series that focused on soloists. And so for our first three, maybe even four seasons, there were a lot of soloists. So solo violin or violin and piano or voice and piano, just because that was something that we felt like was necessary for kind of the variety of music that you could hear. And we've slowly kind of morphed into really living into that fine art or performing arts experience. So now it's more about what fits and what we haven't seen in a while and what audiences say they want to hear or experience. And so that's offered a lot more latitude and variety, I think, which is great, which is fun.
So I'm assuming from what you said before that you're now working on the season for next year?
Yeah. Yes, we've already started talking to artists and managers and negotiating those contracts. And so we're looking at a couple of really interesting things that haven't made, I'll step out and say haven't ever been heard in Chattanooga, at least live. And that's a couple of New Zealand instrumentalists. So bringing over some native Maori instruments, which are called taonga puoro, and those are found instruments, so they're created from shell and bone and wood, and they're used in ceremonial purposes, but then in kind of contemporary classical and popular music, at least in New Zealand, they've entered into very heavily into those particular genres. So there's a couple of artists that we're looking at bringing over for a concert of that, and then looking at some vocal ensembles, and we'll have another pianist, I'm sure, but also some brass, and just kind of, again, looking at what we haven't done in a while and bringing that around.
This is Talking Writing. Our guest, David Taher, the curator of the John Hamm Performance Series up at Covenant College, was born and grew up in New Zealand. As you just heard, he hopes to bring two Maori musicians from New Zealand to play a concert in the series next year. The indigenous music of New Zealand has been enjoying a renaissance in the past couple of decades and has been embraced by a range of performers on the islands. This is a trio composed of two musicians, Kim Halliday and Ora Barlow from New Zealand, together with Sarah Beattie from Scotland. Their music mixes Celtic tunes with Maori songs and instruments. This is WUTC, listener-supported public radio from Chattanooga.